This hour, we'll be hearing excerpts from the Intelligence Squared U.S. debate that took place at Asia Society in New York City on the evening of May 13, 2008. The series of debates is sponsored by the Rosencrantz Foundation, and the proposition this time is, we should legalize the market for human organs. The entry poll recorded the audience as in favor of the motion, 44% voted for it, while only 27% were against, and a large group, 29%, were undecided. After the debate, they will vote again to see if the debaters were able to sway the audience with their arguments. The moderator for the night was Ira Flatow, host of NPR's Science Friday. We'll hear from him later, but now we'll sample a few of the ideas presented in the opening statements. The first speaker of the night was Sally Satel. She's a resident scholar at the American Enterprise Institute, and she is arguing for the motion.
Today, there are 75,000 people waiting for kidneys. I would still be one of them, but thank goodness a wonderful friend of mine gave me her right kidney 2 years ago. But thousands of others are not going to be as lucky as I was. In New York City, in fact, patients suffer on dialysis, can suffer for up to 8 years before getting a transplant, and so many of them can't survive that long. Despite decades and decades of public education about the virtues of organ donation, the waiting list just gets longer, and the time to transplantation just gets longer. So it's no surprise that desperate patients take matters into their own hands and try to find their own organs. They rent billboards begging people to give them, to save them. Some of them go abroad, and maybe if they go abroad to a place like China, they have to live with the sickening knowledge that the organ they got came from an executed prisoner. But you can't blame these people. They are just trying to save their lives. Now, bless all the altruistic souls who have donated organs, but it's past time to face the fact that altruism is just not enough. Many people need more of an incentive to give. And that's why we need to be able to compensate people who are willing to give a kidney to a stranger to save a life. Here's one proposal. The government should sponsor a regulated system for living donors. Compensation could be something as simple as a contribution to a retirement fund, a tax credit, tuition voucher for the children, possibly health care, all kinds of creative things we could do to benefit people who are willing to give a kidney. Now, what I want to do is have you hear some of the misguided objections that our opponents are going to wage. You may well hear that the transplant list is really not that bad. It's kind of bogus. It's inflated. Really, we don't have to do anything drastic. Well, we do have to do something drastic because of the 75,000 people on the list, it is true. Not every one of them is eligible to get a kidney tomorrow. About a third of them are what's called inactive, meaning that right now they are too fragile for surgery. But why did that happen? It happened because they waited years and years and deteriorated so far during that time that now they couldn't get an organ. Tragically, these were people who were healthy when they were first listed. You'll also hear that the transactions involving organs, any transaction involving organs, is an affront to human dignity. But no one can ever explain to me how a fair, safe, and respectful implementation of incentives is an affront to anyone. But what is a disgraceful assault on human dignity is to sit by and let people die when we have the means to save them. You'll hear that organs and material gain don't mix. Well, I reject this. Beautiful acts are performed every day by people who are moved by a combination of humanitarian and financial motives. Are firemen who rush into a burning building any less heroic in our eyes because they were paid to save us? In the end, our critics...
That was Sally Satel, and next we'll hear from the other side. James Childress directs the Institute for Practical Ethics and Public Life at the University of Virginia. And in his opening statement, you'll hear him speak of cadaveric organs. These are organs from deceased donors, and his opposition to legalizing the market for human organs includes these organs.
There are strong reasons to believe that compensation for cadaveric organs won't increase the supply. Imagine a futures market in organs where individuals contract to provide their organs after their deaths and in return receive a payment now or designate the payment to be provided after their deaths to their families or to a charity. Why wouldn't that work? It seems so obvious. Well, consider that many people don't sign donor cards now because of distrust or mistrust. They worry about being declared dead prematurely or even having their deaths hastened if they have signed a donor card. Well, they would certainly be reluctant to sign a futures contract when the only barrier to the delivery of their organs is the fact that they're not dead yet. We do not need to try such a futile market. There are other options for obtaining cadaveric organs. Our current system works fairly well and can be improved. We can increase education and the use of donor cards and donor registries. And when individuals have not made a decision, we can do a better job in approaching families after their deaths. Some institutions now obtain consent to donation from 70 to 75% of families of patients declared dead by neurological standards who are potential candidates for organ donation. And we can consider other sources, including those declared dead by cardiopulmonary standards. A market is not an idea whose time has come. A market in organs is a bad idea. It is unnecessary, probably ineffective, possibly counterproductive, and would breach our sense of justice by exploiting poor, disadvantaged, and desperate members of our society. Hence, we should not legalize a market in human organs.
Thank you, James Childress.
That was James Childress, and now we'll hear from another speaker for the motion, Amy Friedman. She's a professor of surgery and director of transplantation at the State University of New York Upstate Medical University, and she used part of her opening statement to argue that legalizing payment for organs would bring the practice above ground and make it safer.
Most transplant surgeons agree there would be no justification for ever removing a kidney from a living donor, potentially causing harm to this healthy person if there were sufficient organs from deceased donors. Sure, the early risks, such as death, are known, but the long-term consequences are not. Nevertheless, we allow and celebrate such a healthy person's choice to donate and allow him to accept unknown risks for which there is no compensation. Why are we surprised that more donations don't take place? Our opponents may suggest that payment would be so coercive as to prevent the donor from giving informed consent. This is paternalistic. Why should financial need prevent one's ability to consider the balanced presentations of risk and benefit that donors consider in the currently regulated informed consent process? Reasonable people rationalize risk daily by personal prerogative, at times subjecting themselves to unhealthy conditions and making unsafe choices, such as working deep in the coal mine. Any informed decision balances risk against the prospect of benefit. Though real, the risks of organ donation are likely substantially lower than those assumed by coal miners seeking their livelihoods. Despite the dangers inherent in both cases, the miner, but not the donor, is legally compensated for these risks. There is no dignity in dying without a transplant. Don't blame the patient for listening to his internal will to live. We must offer protection to the donor who answers the recipient's call in a way that is currently legally prohibited. Vote with us to legitimize compensation for the donor's acceptance of risk. Today, the choice is not whether compensation will exchange hands, but whether or not transplant operations and the sale of organs will be regulated and safe.
Thank you.
Next, we'll hear two questions that moderator Ira Flato asked of the panelists. Here's his question for Amy Friedman, who is for the motion, we should legalize the market for human organs.
What role do the insurance companies have in this? In your system that you're proposing, would they decide whether you're able to get a kidney or not? People are so disgusted with them already. Are they going to become more disgusted with a government-run system, even though it's regulated?
You're going to ask a physician what role the insurance company
yes,
should have?
Yes, that's why I'm picking out.
No role. No. You know, in general.
Well, how is that possible in the system that we have now?
Because in general, the insurance companies generally follow Medicare and government guidelines. And as long as we set up something that is reasoned, logical, and supportable, it's hard for them to not follow.
So as everybody acts very reasonably, then this will work. You know anybody who acts very reasonably all the time about things like this?
You know, the concept of how this system would be created requires involvement of multiple parties. There are not just providers. There are not just patients and family members. There are clergy. There are social workers. And yes, I think it would be reasonable to have some representatives from the major insurance companies, for example, to be part in the development of these multidisciplinary panels as they agree on what is the best policy for doing this. It has to be a uniform policy, and the way the law would need to be written would be to require that these activities go through the single processor.
Let me just ask
that was Amy Friedman. Next, we'll hear Ira's question for Frank Delmonico. He's director of medical affairs of the Transplantation Society, and he is against the motion.
Back to this later. You seem to feel very strongly about this issue. Do you think this is a strong enough issue that it should be brought up on this presidential election year?
Fine. Yes, I do. I think that medical tourism is going to be a very important aspect for all of us in this room. Countries are now seeking rich patients to come to that country for care. It becomes a very big industry. And the social inequity of that is two ways. If you go to a South American country that is attracting patients to come there, patients within that country unable to receive that care because there is an internal brain drain of sort that is intended for the rich patients to arrive there. Deceased donation has been impacted in the Middle East because you can go to Asia to buy a kidney. So in this global context of medical tourism, I think our presidential candidates are going to have to think about this. Yes, indeed.
Good questions if we ever
These are excerpts from a live Intelligence Squared debate. We'll now hear an excerpt of Lloyd Cohen's opening statement. He's a professor of law at George Mason University, and he is for the motion.
Ladies and gentlemen, I want to make the question before you as authentic and personal as possible. Imagine that when you leave here tonight, you learn that your child's kidneys are failing and that without a transplant, she will die. The problem for you is how to obtain an organ for her. She could receive one from a living donor. Both she and the donor can live quite well with one healthy kidney. But what if no relative or friend is both compatible and willing to donate? Perhaps you might pay someone to supply this superfluous kidney and thereby save your child's life. Alas, that would be illegal. You, the vendor, and anyone who aids you in this will be subjected to imprisonment. Odd, isn't it, that if she were attacked by an assailant, you were permitted to use deadly force to save her life. But when she is attacked by disease, you may not pay a willing vendor to provide an organ. Bizarre as this may sound, the law draws no distinction between organs from the living and organs from the deceased. Here, too, offering or accepting compensation for deceased donor organ is a felony. Our position is not that every conceivable market in human organs is ethically acceptable. Rather, it is that at least some are. Our opponents, on the other hand, object to and would prohibit any and all personal reward being offered to providers of organs. They oppose payments for living donation. They oppose payments to next of kin for the organs of a deceased relative. They oppose offering an options contract to healthy people for delivery of their organs after death. They even oppose the life share system of giving a priority to transplant organs to those willing to make the commitment to their own deceased organ donation. Though in this debate we are not arguing in favor of any particular proposal to reward providers, I will outline one such proposal, the one with which I am most closely associated. The market I propose is one in which healthy individuals might contract for the sale of their organs and tissue for delivery after their death. If the vendor's organs are retrieved and transplanted, a payment in the range of $5,000 for each major organ would be made to a person or institution chosen by the donor. If you compensate people for something, they will provide more of it than if you don't. Every economist who has written on the question, including Nobel Prize winner Gary Becker, has argued in favor of using personal incentives to increase the supply of transplant organs. The price of the prohibition on the sale of human organs is the death of many thousands of people each year.
1 minute.
Were the suffering and death of the victims of this pernicious policy more visible, the stale and empty pieties about the sacred human body being bespoiled by the profane market would be revealed for the vacuous moral posturings that they are. Such moralizing, rather than reflecting an adherence to noble principles, instead bespeaks a fanatical adherence to abstract, inapposite principles by those who are well isolated from the horrific human consequences of their folly. It is not the payment for organs that offends human dignity, but rather the fanatical unwillingness to save thousands of lives by permitting such payments that is a great offense to human dignity.
Thank you.
That was Lloyd Cohen. The last opening statement comes from David Rothman. He's a professor of social medicine at Columbia University's College of Physicians and Surgeons, and he is against the motion.
And that is that although it seems very commonsensical to think that if we make a market, it will increase the supply, there are very, very good reasons, many drawn from behavioral economics, that suggest that, in fact, to create a market might diminish the supply, not increase it. In the first instance, if I can buy it, why should I give it? All right, family member comes down with kidney disease. I could give it, but I've been pretty well off these days. I can buy it. Yes, the risk is minimal, but why should I take any risk if I can go out and put down $16,000s to purchase a kidney? It wouldn't make any sense. I wouldn't have my children donate if I could purchase. There's a wonderful example of this. The name should be familiar to some of you, at least. Richard Titmuss, English sociologist who studied blood donations in England and the U.S. What he discovered is that in England, where the sale of blood was not allowed, rates of donation were considerably higher than the U.S., where the sale of blood was allowed. Eventually, we move away from sale. The Titmuss data is pretty convincing. Watch out about markets. Another example of this, I'll do it rapidly, but it's a great study, took place in an Israeli nursery. 4 o'clock in the afternoon, you were supposed to pick up your child. Most made it, some didn't make it. There was lateness. You excused yourself, you felt bad, and you tried not to do it again. Then some wise social scientists tried an experiment. They told the daycare center went along with this, let's institute a fine. So they instituted a fine on the theory that if we fine people for coming late, the amount of lateness will go down. You know, of course, what happened. No sooner did they institute the fine than the rate of lateness went up. Why? It's simple. It became not a moral obligation, not my duty to the caretakers, but a price. And if I could afford the price, I would come late. The data came in very nicely. The social scientists then added another wonderful little twist. They took away the fine, and then they watched the rate of lateness. What happened then? The rate of lateness stayed high, much higher than before. Their bottom line, and they weren't thinking of this in our context, but it's gorgeous, once a commodity, always a commodity. Don't experiment easily. Once a commodity, always a commodity. Think a little bit about what it would be like to live in a society where we had a market in organs. Now, first response, of course, would be, the poor will be out there donating, and haven't we done well by them? From everything we know in third world countries, you sell your organ, you're out of debt for a very short period of time, you're back in debt right thereafter. The reasons for your debt are not going to be rescued by sale. Secondly, imagine, even after this administration is gone, you have in your possession, right there on your either side of you, a $150,000 commodity. Medicaid regs, before you go on Medicaid, you will sell that organ. We've got some good enterprising folks from Wall Street in the audience, I'm sure. $125,000 tax-free invested when you're 18. Mighty tempting. When do you tell your prospective bride that you can pay the down payment? What do you do when your father-in-law turns to you and says, have you sold your kidney yet? What do you do when your kid comes and he says, I want to go to the Ivy League, not to my state school? And you as the parent say, I can't afford it, but you've got your kidney.
Thank you.
That was David Rothman. Here's moderator Ira Flato asking a question of Lloyd Cohen, who is for the motion.
We just heard, and I want to ask Lloyd, who is very feels very strongly about, is very animated about this topic. You just sat here and listened to this. What is it? And he made a very emotional case about, you know, everything that you don't believe in on this topic. What is your reaction to, you know, would you want to live in a society where kidney cells, where all 18 to 20-year-olds can sell a kidney for $50,000 or $100,000 to pay for an education? Well, are we going down the road to hell doing this?
First of all, David, he wants you to answer a different question when you vote later. He wants it to be the question on live kidney sales. Well, that isn't the resolution. The resolution is quite clear. Should we legalize the market for human organs? So he gives you the list of horribles of the worst conceivable market and says, vote against that. I tell you, there's a slew of possible markets, many of them quite innocent, including merely a cadaveric market, clearly distinguishable. And that falls within this notion of a market in organs. Now, I can see no particular, I can't imagine a society in which people would feel pressured, you know, to sell an organ for cash. It's an invasion. And it's just a list of horribles that doesn't exist anywhere and that will not exist here.
David, you want to answer that?
I can do it quickly. Trust me, we wouldn't be here if we were talking about annuities for cadaveric organs. The reason we're here...
That's a cadaver, right? Cadaveric.
Yes,
okay.
Sorry.
Just no. My radio thing coming through with it.
We wouldn't be here if we were talking about futures markets. We're here for one...
That's not true. I've been arguing for this for 20 years.
But you're not what's captured the public attention, and you're not what's driving the interest. What's driving the interest is... You're not.
I'm very interested.
What's driving the interest is donation from living folks. You know, none of us... Look, we could quibble over this or that with a futures market. Already I thought we heard...
So you're willing to switch sides and come
side
and be with me on that one? No,
the reason why I wouldn't switch sides with you is because of my fear of the contagion effect.
Oh, if the slippery slope nonsense.
All right, well, gentlemen. Gentlemen.
There is no slope here.
Gentlemen.
There are sharp, clear ledges.
I'm using the wrong phraseology. Maybe she can call you.
These are excerpts of a live Intelligence Squared debate. Now, we'll hear a section of the debate where the debaters question their opponents. Here's Sally Satel, who is for the motion, we should legalize the market for human organs. She's questioning James Childress. Here she's quoting his writing from 1992.
You said it would be odd to structure a system designed to promote altruistic behavior with the goal of saving human life when a system that relied on financial incentives could save more lives. Well, okay, that was 1992. Fast forward 14 years to 2006 when you were the head of the Institute of Medicine report on organ donation. And in answer to the question that the report posed, what should we do about even considering, even pursuing a pilot trial of incentives, you had said, or the report said, but I know you concurred with it, it is not time yet. Now, the report spent a lot of time, I'll be quick, on cadaver donation. I'll just say very quickly, believe it or not, even though 2 million people die a year, perhaps 20,000 are eligible to become organ donors. It's just not that easy to be eligible as a cadaver. So even if we used every deceased person, there wouldn't be enough. So your focus on deceased donation would not help. I'm all for it, but that's not going to be enough. So my question to you is...
I was wondering whether we'd get to
we'll
that.
Get to, here it is. If it wasn't time then, in 2006... When is it going to be time? How many more people are going to have to die until we can have your permission to finally at least have a trial of incentives?
First of all, I still affirm all those positions, and they're not incompatible with each other. Basically, my view is that we should give the kind of system we have preference. And by the way, it's not simply an altruistic system. People have a lot of different motives for donating organs. We get confused when we identify altruism with donation. People are often donating, say, for example, a family member's organ because they want to gain some meaning out of a tragedy that's occurred. They may be donating as a living person an organ, again, because of the relationships involved that don't have to do specifically with altruism. I think we have not yet given a fair chance to the system we have in that we have not yet put the resources and energy into it. There are only 13 to 16,000 people who are declared dead by neurological standards who could probably donate organs. There are another, on a conservative estimate, 20,000 plus who are declared dead by cardiopulmonary standards, and that is a direction that the IOM report recommended that at least merits a trial. But since I happen to agree with Lloyd on this, not much else, but at least on this, that we ought to be giving preference to the cadaveric system over the living, in part because, as Amy noted, we actually don't know a lot about the long-term risk, which we do need to know. So it's a matter of structuring this in terms of preferential systems. And the IOM report did not rule it out completely, but held that let's see if this will work.
I'm going to give you an opportunity now, James, to ask a question if you'd like.
Let me raise this of Lloyd, because Lloyd, other than perhaps sensing a kind of market fundamentalism here, I cannot for the life of me see how you think the system you propose would work. If donors now, people who are potential donors, are not willing to sign a donor card because they don't trust the system, they worry that they'll be declared dead prematurely or have their deaths hastened, why would anyone be willing to sign a contract for a delivery of organs after his or her death for money when that would seem to me to be the least trustworthy system?
James, he asserts people are not willing to sign now because they don't trust the system and they're afraid of being declared prematurely dead. Where does he get this information from? From idiot surveys. No good social scientist relies on such evidence. You know, no economist ever wants to make use of a survey. People say anything in a survey. You know, use a little bit of introspection as to why it is you may or may not sign an organ donor card. People in general don't want to contemplate their own violent, immediate, surprising death and dismemberment. Great surprise.
Amy, it's your turn to.
And this is for James. If you object to paying live donors because the poor would allegedly be coerced by poverty into making an unwise choice, do you have any objections to the middle class selling a kidney? It would not be difficult to restrict organ sales to those whose income is at least 70% of the American median. Sure, that would make kidneys more expensive. We could live with that. How about you? Does taking the desperately poor out of the picture make you relent, or do you now move to the paternalistic position that no one should accept any amount of money?
The issue has to do in part with a relative deprivation disadvantage. You used several different terms in the discussion, disadvantage being one of them. That's often relative rather than absolute in regard to, say, a poverty level. I think that the way you're raising the question here, I focused on obviously the extreme version of it, those in desperate straits. The problem I think you would have is once you set up a system, you're not going to be able to restrict it to the kind of level you indicated, wherever we want to set it in terms of income level, because you're going to be then charged with discrimination against the poor and their opportunity to obtain it. That the system would be unstable the way you sketched it.
Okay. Next question. Frank, you can.
So this is for Amy. And I do so asking her, in the reality of the market that Dr. Freeman wants to have now exists, she's the transplant surgeon. She's got a 72-year-old patient in front of her. And by her market system, there's a 56-year-old middle class who's before her as well. The 56-year-old has come forward and is prepared to sell his kidney. And now I'd like to know from Dr. Friedman the following. Would you advise your 72-year-old patient to accept a 56 or 60-year-old, when the insurance company of this patient is saying, we can get you to Manila tomorrow and we can have a 20-year-old kidney for you. If the alternative is that the patient could go out of country for a 20-year-old versus your market system that will only provide the 56 or 60-year-old, what would you advise your patient?
Dr. Friedman?
The construct of the system has to be along the lines of what we have with Medicare now, and that is that patients who currently go out of this country to have transplants at non-Medicare-approved transplant centers don't have their medications paid for subsequently.
That's not true.
That's prohibited.
But it's not true.
What is
end of discussion, that's not true. You can come back, and if you're Medicare eligible, you'll have your medications paid
Frank,
for.
We're now required to inform every patient that if they don't have their transplant performed at a Medicare-approved center, Medicare won't pay for their medications. That's the type of system that we ought to proceed with.
Is this patient going out of country? Is a patient going out of country or not?
They shouldn't be permitted to be because they won't have access to medications and other care.
Okay, Lloyd, you get it.
These are excerpts of a live Intelligence Squared U.S. debate. And here is Lloyd Cohen. He is for the motion we should legalize the market for human organs. And he is asking a question of Frank Delmonico.
Now, unlike the other participants in this debate, I'm not a good and generous person. It's true. Ask my daughter. She's there. I am so callous and uncaring that I wrote a codicil to my will disinheriting any member of my family who consents to the donation of any of my organs unless they are paid at least $864.37 per organ. I have posted this on my webpage, and other people have downloaded it and amended their wills accordingly. Now I ask you, Dr. Pangloss, I mean Dr. Delmonico. Is your objection to my estate profiting from the salvaging of my organs so strong that you think it just and right to threaten innocent sick people with prison for purchasing my organ? Is there some great ethical principle that I do not understand under which the sick should be condemned to die rather than obtain organs from the self-interested and even selfish?
No, the problem isn't that they would have to buy your organs. It's that they'd go elsewhere. They won't want your organs, Lloyd. They're going to go to Manila for the 20-year-old. Thank you.
I don't think that was an answer, Frank.
Well, yes, it is an answer. The answer is that they're going to be in a position when you have legalized markets to say, who wants your organs in your circumstance when I can go to Manila to buy one from a 20-year-old? That's the answer.
I'm going to break the rules. Sally wants to jump in. She's the only one who's ever bought an organ here.
I thought about it.
So let's get some practical experience.
Frank, I don't understand. We can do that now. I can go to Manila now. So I don't see why having a mechanism where organs can be compensated for by a third party makes any difference at all.
And here's David Rothman, who is against the motion, asking a question of Sally Satel.
Given what we know about Enron, given what we know, at least according to some, about the way hedge funds work, given these examples, what makes you confident that a regulatory system where everyone could enter the market could possibly work?
Now, the kind of system I have in mind is a straw man I think you guys keep setting up. We are not talking about a classic commercial free-for-all or a free market or an eBay system. We're talking about a third-party payer. For example, today you, Ira, could decide to give a kidney. You'd be called a Good Samaritan donor. You would show up at the New York Med, and you'd say, please give my organ to the next person on the list in this region, in this hospital, in the country, and they would do it. The only difference in a model that we're thinking of, or I'm thinking about, is where you go and give your organ, and to your retirement account is wired $40,000. End of story. Everything else is the same. The screening you go through, the same medical checkup, everything.
Okay, we now have time for a question and answers from the audience, and go ahead.
Well, my name's John Fung, and I was fortunate to have been involved in the care of Robert Casey, who was then the governor of Pennsylvania, having been part of the team that had performed combined heart and liver transplant on him. And shortly after his transplant, he met the family of the donor. The donor's mother relayed to Governor Casey at the time that the funeral expenses for her son. They couldn't come up with the money for it. And as it turns out, funeral directors charge an additional amount on the order of about $300 because of the donation process. And so Governor Casey at the time came up with Act 102, which provided the opportunity for citizens of Pennsylvania to donate a dollar as part of their annual tax.
Mr. Fong, I'm going to have you get to your question.
I'm sorry.
I have
so
other people
the question, all right, the $300 that was assigned to be allowed to pay for this funeral expenses was never implemented, even though it was approved by the state legislature. And the reason was because it was thought to be against the federal regulations, the National Organ Transplant Act. So I think one of the comments is, why not allow a pilot study?
Okay.
American Medical Association approved it.
Any comments? Why not allow a pilot study to see how?
Well, I really don't have great problems with giving Pennsylvania a try. Frank and Jim may... But that's not what we're debating tonight.
Come to the side.
What are we giving a try? Well,
okay, Frank, what well, would you be willing to give something a try? Well, or anything that they're... Some form of
there's a guy in Taiwan, Formosa Plastics, a generous man. Every time somebody dies whose family donates a kidney, he gives them several hundred dollars for burial expenses. This crowd wouldn't be here if we were debating $300 for burial expenses.
Let me ask Jay. Jim, what
first of all, I have no problem with that experiment. I wish it had been implemented. It's an expression of gratitude to the donors. That is very different from setting up an incentivized system
right.
of the sort for living vendors, and they're not donors. They are vendors if we're paying them to donate. Why not do an experiment? Because so much of what we've said today on both sides is actually a matter of speculation. We don't know whether some of these proposals will be effective or not. We don't know whether they'll have bad consequences. I think the main reason we should not change the federal and several state laws in order to allow some of the kinds of experiments that have been proposed would be precisely that we would then cross the barrier that once you've made the organs into a commodity, you won't be able to turn back. And that the experiments, I think, would be dangerous to do.
Well, we got half a loaf.
Okay. I have to make one. This is directly contrary to what the IOM report of 2 years ago, of which weren't you?
That's the Institute of Medicine?
Institute of Medicine report, which said no experiments, no trials, nothing.
All right, let's go get another question here from the audience.
My question is directly a follow-up on the preceding question, and it's directed at Dr. Friedman. You pointed out before that there may be some long-term consequences to donors, but the number that always appears in the literature is that only 0.03% of donors die as a result in the long term or even in the short term of donating a kidney. So it sounds like a very safe thing to do. Why aren't the major advocacy organizations doing more pilot research to assess whether there are any long-term risks, and also doing research on what types of compensation systems would mitigate some of the objections raised by the other side?
Amy, do you want to handle that?
Thank you for your comments on live donor safety. It's critically important. Nobody's done these long-term studies because we don't have a mechanism to capture and retain information about the donors 20 and 30 years out, and we don't have the means of paying for it. Right now, we can have a donor who has no medical insurance whatsoever come and donate a kidney because the recipient's insurance pays for it, but we have no mechanism after they get through the early post-operative period to pay for their care. That's expensive, and that's a part of what would need to be in a regulated system. And thank you very much. All of the advocacy organizations, the American Society of Transplant Surgeons, the American Society of Transplantation, the government, and everybody at this table on both sides very much agrees that we need to capture the information about donors. We just can't afford to, and in the absence of universal health care or a single system, we can't do it because they just escape. We can't track them.
Frank, did you want to respond?
Yes, I do. 4,000 people dying on the list. 40% of the people who are dying are not in need of kidneys. They would not, the market system would not affect them by having more organs available because you can't buy a heart. You can't, unless you're in Egypt, you can't buy a liver. You can't buy a lung. One of the problems of the proposal is the assumption that those patients would still have a cadre of deceased organs available. But that experiment's been done in Hong Kong and in other places. When you have markets, the deceased donation is negatively impacted. So right away, when you say 4,000 people are dying on the list, not quite, but almost half are dying in need of organs that the market system will not impact. Now, next, on the kidney front, of those that are dying, we need to make an assessment of why they're dying and whether or not that is simply because they've not received an organ. Some of the patients that are dying on the list have been on that list for an extended period of time, inactive. Inactive means that you do not receive an offer for a kidney. The market system will not impact an individual that is inactive on the list. Currently, 33% of the list waiting for kidneys, 24,000 patients are inactive on the list. That needs to be evaluated further. Before we go down the road of a market, we better assess the wait list of the premise to have markets.
Okay. We've run out of time for this session.
You're listening to an IQ Squared debate on the proposition we should legalize the market for human organs. And we'll now hear excerpts of just a few of the closing statements. Each speaker has 2 minutes, and they alternate between the two sides. We'll start with James Childress, who is speaking against the motion.
Jim, you go first.
Thanks. I have never said that our current system is working well enough. I think we have a good system, not yet a great system, and I think we need to do a lot more to improve it, and I think we can do so. And I would just note in response to Amy's comment that we simply can't afford to develop a mechanism to follow up on living donors. If we can't afford to do that, then we cannot afford to do what we need to do to make a market in living vendors and sellers for kidneys work. We should not, I would argue, damage or destroy our system, which is not working as well as it should, and we need to improve, by adopting a flawed market in organs. Our opponents have proposed a radical change in our organ transplant system, and yet they have failed, in my judgment, to satisfy the burden of proof required for a drastic alteration of a system that is working fairly well and that can be further improved. By contrast, we've, I think, given good reasons for suspicion of such a market, and I hope that you will vote no against legalizing a market in organs.
Sally, you have 2 minutes.
Okay.
Sally Satel.
Thanks. Well, during the time we've been here tonight, yes, someone has died. And this was a real person with a real family who would have lived if there were enough organs. It may sound maudlin, but it's very true. And this is why we need to compensate donors. Altruism, or whatever is in that area between being paid and giving an organ, is not enough. And insisting that it remain the basis for transplant policy is a reckless and derelict stance that will only guarantee a future of suffering, and not just for the patients, but for who will languish and die on dialysis, but for black market donors as well. Our opponents hate the black market. Well, so do we. But somehow we learned something they never did, that the only way to stop illicit transactions is to sanction legal ones. Simply clamping down on illicit sales only drives it further underground or causes it to blossom somewhere else. And the only way out of this tragic bind is to increase the supply. And the only way to do that is through a fair, transparent, safe, and legal means of exchange. Until then, the fate of third world donors and the patients who need their organs to live will remain tragically entwined. And until then, our opponents, who refuse to allow even experimentation with compensation, will be complicit, yes, complicit, in fostering the organ trade. We welcome the other side to work with us, but as you've seen, they've never met a proposal they didn't reject or attack. They have a dearth of creative ideas, but an abundance of passion for obstructing innovation. In closing, unless we establish a legal market for kidneys in some form, we should brace ourselves for more needless suffering and death. Our side refuses to stand for that, and so should you. It's too high a price for a humane society to bear.
Thank you. On the against side, David Rothman.
Your 2 minutes.
Some quick principles. First, beware of doctors who play regulators and economists. What you've heard from the physicians is fantasy. I'm not sure lawyers are much better at it, having heard Lloyd, but this is, you're in a never-never land, truly in a never-never land. Sally came out with a formulation which those of us in New York get a little scared about. The only way to stamp out illicit behavior is to legalize it. I can think of commercial sex work, but I don't want to go there. Second, don't think that you're doing the poor a favor. You want to do the poor a favor, start thinking in terms of economic development. Watch what China did. Watch what India is in the process of doing. Massive infusions of capital, growth, real change. This kind of pittance of giving the poor a little money here so that they can, you know, sell their body part, that's absurd. You want to do something for the poor, do it in a real way. Spur economic development. Finally, you're not doing the middle class any favor here either. I made that point with college. There's got to be a better way to pay for an expensive wedding. Don't go down that route.
Speaking for final words, Lloyd Cohen.
So much pernicious, pretentious foolishness to refute, so little time. Are you shocked and surprised that anyone would argue that paying for organs will not increase the supply? I was at first, and then it became clear. The prospect of an effective organ market places our opponents behind the eight ball. A market that would recover vital organs now being fed to worms would be the salvation of thousands of patients. As against the saving of innocent lives, poetic statements about the dignity of human life being degraded by commercialism would be revealed as empty moral pieties. Our opponents would therefore prefer to believe that a market would not work and demand that we must prove that it will. The obvious way to demonstrate the efficacy of a market is to permit one. But of course, the law forbids that. So what other evidence or theory can I offer? First, consider the thriving organ market from living donors in places like India. A market in the U.S. where the interest of donors would be safeguarded by American law would, of course, be much more successful. And there's no reason to think that somehow the American market would be like the Indian market. In the same way, there's no reason to think, if any of you have been to India, that potable water from the tap is as common in India as it is in the United States.
1 minute.
And what does the success of living donor market say about a market in cadaver organs? The sacrifice is incomparably greater for the living donor than for the deceased, so the supply of deceased donors will be far more responsive to a positive price. Second, look to the very reason that our opponents have such faith in the efficacy of altruism, and at the same time restrict its required application to organs rather than extend it to surgical services, nursing, and hospital care. They believe that altruism should work for transplant organs because they are of no value to the dead and of enormous value to the ill. Whatever this vast disparity should say about the power of altruism, it speaks volumes in the world of markets. Everywhere we look, markets move goods from low-valued uses to high-valued ones. Third, I've got 17 more reasons, but you'll have to talk to me privately.
There you go. Thank you all.
And that concludes our debate. When the audience had finished voting on the proposition we should legalize the market for human organs, the speakers for the motion had increased their lead considerably. The entry poll, once again, was 44% for the motion and 27% against. At the end, the audience voted 60% for the motion and 31% were against, and 9% still didn't know. So the side for the motion carried the day. To hear the full unedited version of this or other debates in the IQ Squared series, or to subscribe to our podcast, visit npr.org/intelligencesquared. The Intelligence Squared U.S. Debate Series is an initiative of the Rosencrantz Foundation, Chairman Robert Rosencrantz, Executive Producer Dana Wolf. For more information about this series, or to find out how you can get tickets to future live events, visit www.iq2us.org. That's IQ, the numeral 2, US.org. The goal of Intelligence Squared U.S. is to raise the level of public discourse in American life and to recognize that on most contentious issues, both sides have intellectually respectable views. The series is produced for radio by WNYC in New York, producer Rob Christensen, executive producer Ellen Horn. The recording was engineered by Damon Whittemore, Edward Haber, Bart Silverman, and Stacey Abbott. Intelligence Squared US is distributed by NPR, National Public Radio.